But in any case, before I begin, I want to say one thing. You already know the title of the talk, but you don't know who's behind it. One of the people that I've been working with on this issue in this research is Todd Henderson, who's sitting right over here. And so he'll make sure I don't make any mistakes, I think. So let's get started. So what do I want to do? I want to start out by telling you, giving you a roadmap of what I'm going to do in this lecture. First, I'm going to try to convince you that corporate philanthropy is important. Okay, some of you might already accept this. Some of you might say, I mean, really, do corporations really do any good? So I'm going to try to put some numbers to that and show that there is something going on there, and it's important to understand. Then I'm going to give you a lay of the land when it comes to positive and normative theories of corporate philanthropy. And then I'm going to tell you why they're, well, in some ways, all right, and in some ways, they've got it completely wrong. I'm going to give you an alternative theory for corporate philanthropy. I'm going to tell you how to really think about it and hopefully shape the way that you view discussions of corporate philanthropy. Then I'm going to kind of give you the costs and benefits of corporate philanthropy. So when you're deciding as a donor, as a consumer, should you facilitate, should you participate in corporate philanthropy, I'm going to give you some pointers here. And then finally, I'm going to talk to you about something that you probably, except for the fraction of you that take tax law, would prefer to avoid discussing, the importance of tax to corporate philanthropy. Okay? So let me begin. So how important is corporate philanthropy? How important is it? And I don't mean in a metaphysical way, you know, are they doing good, are they doing bad? I'm asking in a quantitative way. Is there a lot of money that goes from corporations to good causes? Okay, roughly put, without commenting on what is good and what is bad. And I'm going to argue, you know, there's good reason to think that it's actually quite large, the amount of money that flows through from corporations to good causes. So let me give you some data points on this. So I think the one thing that you guys probably appreciate, but maybe not appreciate enough, is that if you take a look at the total amount of money, the total amount of assets that are under professional management, financial assets under professional management in the United States, 10% of that, 10% of that is invested in funds that have a social restriction. That is to say, they won't invest in tobacco, they won't invest in guns, they'll invest in environmentally friendly companies, things like that. They have a restriction. They won't just try to invest your money in entities that'll give you the highest rate of return. They're saying, we like return, but we want to make sure that you're socially conscious. Now, we also know that when you invest in these funds, you typically lose about 3.5% of return, 35 basis points. Okay? 35 basis points. What does that mean? If you take the total amount of assets that are under management, multiply by 10%, then multiply by 0.0035, you will get $84 billion. So that's one estimate of how much money you, and here I mean you, the American public, are willing to sacrifice in terms of foregone returns in order to invest in socially responsible companies. I'll give you another example that you probably know about, green products. Now by green products, I don't just mean environmentally friendly products, I mean all sorts of products. So when you buy fair trade coffee at Starbucks, that's a green product in my classification. When you buy a Prius, that's a green product in my classification. So how many of you buy products that not only help you, but help some other cause, okay? Help the environment, help the poor, something like that. How many of you participate in the red campaign by buying at the Gap? Things like that. If you include green products, if you define green products this way, roughly 10% of all new products introduced into the economy each year are green products in this respect. And there are some estimates that suggest that the market for these green products, conservatively estimated, is $209 billion. Okay, now we don't know how much of that is cost, how much of that is the green product, the green component of the product, but that'll give you another estimate of how large this number is. Also, you probably all know, you've gone through recruiting season, at least, I don't know how many of you, actually, I'd guess almost all, everybody here at some point, right, by this time of the season, have gone through some sort of recruiting process, either trying to get jobs for the 1L summer or going through fall recruiting for post 2L summer and final employment. Well, you know that employers, now obviously for you it's mainly law firms, tell you about how all the nice things they do for good causes and how you can participate. They'll tell you about, most important for you, is pro bono work that you can do and that you will be paid for. Okay, they'll pay for you to volunteer to work for some organization. Some of them, especially more corporate, less law firm organizations, will also have employee matching programs. You donate $1,000 to United Way, they'll donate $1,000 to United Way, right? You'll also see, for example, more and more surveys that suggest that people like you are willing to work less, work for less, in order to work for a firm or a company that does good things, right? You would prefer to work for a firm that engages in a lot of pro bono activities, even if you're not doing them directly, or that, you know, does capital defense work, or works for the environment, or something like that. If you're willing to take any kind of wage cut, then you're donating money through a corporation to a good cause. We know that there's a lot of this, and we know that it's growing rapidly, just by announcements of how important this is. In fact, right, who's sponsoring your lunch? Wachtell Lipton. They've got a whole page on the pro bono work they do. If you look in the AM 100 ranking where, you know, Wachtell says it's number one, I guarantee you one of the important considerations is pro bono work. This is very, very important to workers, you, right? That's why they tell you about it, and it's a growing program. Now, what does this result in, right? People are sacrificing returns, people are purchasing green products, they're working for less, or working or volunteering through work. What is the output of that? One output of that is corporate donations. Corporate donations are money that corporations give to nonprofits or to end users that we think are needy, the poor, the environment, you name it. Corporate donations total over $20 billion a year. That's not a small sum, $20 billion a year. And if you look at the top 10 foundations in the United States, five of them are corporate foundations. Actually, you may not like this, they're all sponsored by drug companies. So Pfizer, Merck, these sorts of things. But put that aside for a second. That's another political issue. But top five, right? And only one of the top 10 foundations, right? Five of them are corporate, five of them are individual corporations, like individual foundations like the Gates Foundation, things like that. Only one of them have living donors. What does that mean? That means that there are five corporate, four kind of old foundations that were established a long time ago, like the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and one that has a donor that is living and continues to donate, and that's Bill Gates. Yeah, yes, Bill Gates is number one on the foundation list, but the others are close. Okay? So foundation donations are importantly corporate, and corporate donations overall, quite large. Now, that's not the only way that corporations help the environment, or help the poor, or help any other needy cause. Okay? It's not just cash they hand out, it's their activities. They can do good. And it's very hard to figure out how important this is, but I'll give you one example. Unfortunately, there are no regulations in the United States governing CO2 emissions. Okay? Greenhouse gases. That means that any action that a corporation takes to reduce CO2 emissions is voluntary. Is a form of philanthropy, arguably, okay? At least on its own. So we just have to count up, for example, how much money corporations are paying trying to reduce CO2 emissions. And we have a colleague that visited here just last quarter, Michael Vandenberg, somebody who might have taken his class, and his conservative estimate of the amount of overcompliance there is in CO2 is $30 billion. And that's just CO2, and he thinks that's a lower bound estimate, because if you look at the number of people, number of products, number of companies that are saying, we care about global warming, we're doing something about it, you see that it's rising. Every day there's a new announcement. And this is just CO2. Doesn't include other things. Okay? Doesn't include other things. Okay, so what is the implication? How much is this? Tab this all up. I think that it's easy to be persuaded that corporate philanthropy accounts for at least $200 billion per year of contributions to good causes. $200 billion per year. How big is that? Is $200 billion a big number? Well, obviously, if you look at the total economy, $25 trillion, that doesn't seem like a lot. But maybe a better comparison is how much individuals donate to nonprofits, to charities. Okay, these are donations to charities. Total individual donations to charities is $229 billion, roughly on par with the amount of corporate philanthropy. If you also count volunteering, and this is notoriously hard to figure out how much volunteering there is, and right? Because it's not like I keep logbooks, and we don't pay for it, so we don't have an incentive to get the numbers right, and we don't know how to assign a wage to those hours that we volunteer. But let's ignore that for a second. If you come up with volunteering, you might, if you try to study this, Todd and I have come up with numbers that range from $174 billion to $239 billion. Okay, so put it all together, what's the bottom line? Corporate philanthropy, I think quite conservatively, accounts for half of all philanthropy that occurs in the United States by private entities. By the way, I say private entities because I'm ignoring the government for a second. We'll get to the government in just a bit. Okay? So 50%, and it's growing rapidly. You look at the amount, the rate at which individual contributions to charity are growing, right? They peaked actually right after 9/11 when there was a big surge, but since then have gone back to their historical growth rate. Doesn't compare to corporate philanthropy, which is virtually non-existent 25 years ago. Okay? So you should care about corporate philanthropy, not only as a participant, but because it's important to good causes. And everybody likes good causes, right? Why not? It's hard to say you don't. Okay, so now what do people say? When I say people, I mean academics, social commentators, you name it, right? Pundits. What do they say about corporate philanthropy? What are the kind of critical theories that exist, and what are the complementary theories? What theories think that corporate philanthropy is bad, and why do people think that corporate philanthropy is good? Well, I'll give you an old view. It's critical of corporate philanthropy. And I think it finds its roots in an old Milton Friedman argument that says, look, corporations shouldn't do philanthropy, they should maximize profits. If you want to do philanthropy, or if managers of the corporation want to do philanthropy, make a lot of money, bring it home, and then privately donate it. Okay, that's the way it should work. Keep these two things separate. Now, when then people started seeing corporate philanthropy, that is to say good causes, donations to good causes, activities, things like that, being done by corporations, that's not good. They asked, why does that exist? And the most common explanation is, this is just a form of agency problem. That is to say, we have shareholders, they invest in companies, the companies are run by managers and CEOs and boards of directors, it's very hard to control what they do. Sometimes they misbehave. And one way they misbehave is by donating money that rightfully belongs to shareholders, donating that money to their pet charitable causes. It's not causes that the shareholders care about. It's causes that the managers, the CEO cares about. Why do they do it? Well, because it's nice to donate to the local opera as the CEO, because then you get treated very well at the local opera. Or you get the reputational benefit of you being responsible for donating to the Art Institute. You name it. The benefit flows to the CEO. So that's the standard argument. It's managers fleecing shareholders. Just like building a bigger office, right? You could build a bigger office as a CEO, or you could donate to your privately interested local charity, or your personal charity. Now, you might wonder, oh, what is the corporate law? Some of you have taken corporate law and you know the answer to this. Some of you don't know. But you might wonder, what does corporate law, state corporate law, have to say about this sort of fleecing? And originally you might think, well, corporations about profit maximization, that's what the manager is supposed to do, and court should step in. And in fact, there's a very famous case, Dodge v. Ford, which Todd has just recently written about, that says just this, right? This is the Dodge brothers. You might remember the Dodge brothers. Well, even if you don't know them, you certainly remember their legacy, Dodge cars, right? Dodge brothers invested in Ford at the same time that they were operating a competitor of Ford. And Ford, right, gave his workers a pay raise. And he may have had efficiency reasons for doing so, but one of the concerns that the Dodge brothers had, at least publicly they said this, was that Ford was just handing out charity to these workers when he should not be giving those raises, should be distributing to the shareholders, including the Dodge brothers. Okay? So Ford should profit maximize, not hand out pay raises. Now we know what the Dodge brothers also may have been interested in, which is seeing some of that capital so they could invest it in their competing company. But put that aside for a second. The court in this case bought the Dodge brothers' argument. Ford was supposed to maximize profits and give money to his shareholders, not to his workers. Now that was 1919, and that wasn't a very widely, it was widely cited or discussed, but it certainly wasn't a widely followed case. So a case that's more typical, more in the mainstream of how courts handle corporate philanthropy, is Shalensky versus Wrigley, another very fun case. Why? It involves Wrigley Field. And anything involving Wrigley Field, fun, right? Well, involving a balcony and some beer at Wrigley Field is fun. But put that aside. Wrigley. It's a 1968 case. Wrigley doesn't want lights at Wrigley Field. Says baseball is a daytime game. gives some reasons like, oh, well, nighttime games are bad, attracts crime, things like that. And Shalinsky, well, another shareholder says, hey, look, we think it's going to maximize profits. You should do it. You have to do it because it's going to other stadiums are doing this. Other owners are doing this. They're showing higher profits. We get higher profits out of the Cubs if we also did that. And the court says, you know, Wrigley can do whatever he wants. Right? He's the manager. He's not just the owner. He's the manager. He can do whatever he wants. And we're not going to second guess whether or not this is profit maximizing. It's very hard to do that. In effect, saying roughly that the business judgment rule applies to corporate philanthropy. We are not going to judge whether corporate philanthropy is profit maximizing or not, or whether something's philanthropy or not. We're going to let the managers do this. We will just judge the process. Did they think about the issue? And if they did, that's good enough. We're not going to judge the merits. And so what you see is cases later on like Kahn v. Sullivan. Now those names don't mean anything, but the names behind it might. So this is Occidental Petroleum, whose CEO is Armin Hammer, who spends $100 million of the corporation's profits in 1 year, 30% of their profits, to build a museum to house his personal art collection. Okay? And you say, oh my God, right? How could this possibly stand? Well, it does. The court says, oh, this is terrible, things like that, but ultimately this is a business judgment rule case. Corporate philanthropy is allowed to stand. And here, this has got to be the extreme of agency costs, right? This is the poster child of what can go wrong. Another example is Hollinger International, right? The Conrad Black case from 2004. Some of you may have heard about Conrad Black, most recently because of the criminal indictment and conviction. But before that, there was the shareholder suit. And that's Hollinger International. And it's littered with examples of managers basically handing out corporate assets to their pet charities. Okay? And we're not doing very much about it. There is proposed legislation by an Ohio representative that says, you know, corporations should disclose all their charitable contributions. That he's proposed it many times. It doesn't pass. There's a New York Stock Exchange listing requirement that says that if a director has the corporation donate money to a charity on which the director sits on the board, you've got to disclose that. But those direct conflict of interest don't garner that much publicity. So here we have it. So corporate philanthropy is an agency cost, and the law does nothing about it. Right? That's the story. Okay, but there must be some people that think corporate philanthropy is good, or at least in a backhanded way, good, right? What do they say? Well, there are two dominant theories, two dominant positive theories, and one normative theory. Let me tell you about them. So the first is that corporate philanthropy is profit maximizing, right? Corporate philanthropy is profit maximizing. So when Toyota sells you the Prius, it's not like they're paying you to buy the Prius, they're charging you more. Okay, you pay for it. In fact, the amount that you pay might be less than the amount it costs them to produce the Prius. They make profits on it. Right? That's charity, corporate philanthropy that's profit maximizing. The corporation is selling philanthropy to you, but making money off it because they can produce the philanthropic product for less than they're charging you. Things like that. And you might think, oh, this is just one way in which corporate philanthropy can be profitable. But there are many others. So for example, I told you some people are more willing to invest or take greater losses if they invest in socially responsible companies. Well, that's implicitly saying the cost of capital is lower if you engage in corporate philanthropy. So maybe you should engage in some corporate philanthropy, produce some green products. It'll be easier for you to raise capital. Hey, some of your workers might like to work for you if you do good things for the environment. That might lower your wages, might reduce turnover at your firm. Well, that's going to increase profits. Even better, if you start doing nice things for the environment, the government might not regulate you, right? Might delay CO2 regulations. That would avoid regulation, avoid other costs. It might be a least costly alternative to government regulation. And of course, I already discussed it might increase demand, right? If I sell the Prius, you like it. You'll pay a little bit more because you want to help the environment. Okay? These are different ways corporate philanthropy is profit maximizing. Now, as a positive theory, this is fine. Okay? There's also a normative bent. Some people say this is good, so you should do corporate philanthropy. People like Michael Porter at Harvard Business School. Alternatively, some people say, I don't like profit taking. I like philanthropy done for philanthropy's sake. So when you're doing it for profit maximization purposes, that's a bad thing. So some people view this as a theory that says it's normatively bad to have philanthropy, right? Corporations are making money off it. We should stop corporate philanthropy. I don't want to discuss the normative component yet. I just want you to understand the positive argument here. Corporations can make money off of doing good. Okay, doing good for others, I should say. Because I got to say, Apple makes a lot of money off of me from selling me the MacBook, and the MacBook is good. Okay? Especially the new one. Okay. Second theory, positive theory for corporate philanthropy. And this is kind of new. We have always talked about corporate philanthropy as a way to help companies make money, but we haven't talked about how it can help the shareholders, the owners of the company, not by making them money, but by making them happy, by giving them greater utility. Why? I already told you that some people are willing to take lower return on stock investments, their investments, if the investments are made in companies that are socially responsible. Why would they do that? Well, a commonsensical explanation is they're doing that because it makes them happy to invest in companies that help the environment or that don't promote tobacco or don't promote guns or you name the cause, they don't do that bad thing. Okay? So that means that they can be happy by owning stock A rather than stock B, even though stock A and stock B yield the same rate of return. It just happens that stock A does nice things for other people. Okay? If you think that's possible, then you might argue, well, corporate philanthropy is a good thing because shareholders get some utility. In fact, it's actually possible for the shareholders to, when we say shareholders forego profits, right? That's one way to increase shareholder utility, right? I said that people are willing to invest in companies even though they guarantee a lower rate of return. That lower rate of return could be because that product is bad, but it could also be because they're not profit maximizing with corporate philanthropy. It costs them $10,000 to make a Prius. I make that number up. It's actually a lot more. It costs $10,000 to make a Prius. They could charge you $15,000, but they only charge you $14,000. So they're paying $1,000. They're foregoing $1,000 of profits to produce the Prius. Why might they do that? Because their shareholders want them to, or it makes their shareholders happier. Okay? If that's the case, then it's generating shareholder utility. So let me turn it around. You own stock. You own stock for two reasons. One, you like to make money. Two, you like what the corporation does, and you're happier when the corporation does good things. Right? And you're going to invest in this company A that does these two things, money and good things, rather than company B, even though company B might offer a higher rate of return. Why? Because there's a compensating differential. There's something else you're getting from A that you're not getting from B, and that is the good works of company A. Hopefully you're finding me redundant right now and understand what the shareholder utility argument is. But the reason I emphasize this is because it's a new idea, right? In the last 3 years, you see people talking about this as a plausible thing that goes on. Now, that said, I should be very careful. Some of you may have taken corporate finance. I've studied Modigliani-Miller, right? That should strike a bell with some of you. It's a theorem that talks about whether companies should finance their business through equity or debt, through stock, issuing stock, or taking out loans or issuing bonds. And the answer is, in theory, they should be indifferent. Why? Because the shareholder, if they do one as opposed to the other, the shareholder can adjust in their own private personal portfolio. Same thing applies, perhaps, to corporate philanthropy. So it's not clear that just because a company, like Company A in my example, was doing some extra corporate philanthropy, that they will suffer in terms of their stock price. Why? Let's suppose a company decides, I'm going to do some corporate philanthropy that'll sacrifice profits, such that the rate of return falls by $100 for the typical shareholder. Well, the typical shareholder, you might think, oh, that would be problematic. But if the typical shareholder was already donating $100 to charity, and private donations to charity, that is to say direct donations to nonprofits, are fungible with or substitutes for donations through your corporation that you own, then when Corporation A does $100 of charity, right, transforms some profits into charity, the individual just responds by reducing the amount of private donations they give. Overall, their demand for the corporation stays the same, so the price stays the same. Now, I can give you variations of this, just as I can with variations on debt versus equity financing, to show how that may hold, may not hold, and things like that. But the key lesson for you is it's not necessarily clear that corporate philanthropy will increase, decrease, or maintain stock price. Okay? It depends on what else is going on and how people personally behave. But again, what can you pull out of it? You may hold stock because you like what the company is doing and not because they're making you money. Okay? Those are the two positive theories. You'll see in a second that I'll argue that they're both right, perhaps. The real question is, are there any normative theories? Yes, there's one, not the real question. One question is, are there any normative theories? Yes. And this is one that you probably see in the pages of the New York Times, or at least in the editorial pages. And what is that? Why should we have corporate philanthropy? Because corporations owe a social obligation to the world. They owe a social obligation to the world. Now, I think Todd and I agree on this. We don't agree on a lot of things, but we agree on this. This is not an argument that makes a lot of sense to us, so I'm not going to pursue it too much. But our basic concern is corporations aren't people. They don't have consciences. They don't have souls, whatever is your determinant of responsibility. And so we don't know what this means, that corporations owe a social obligation. Typically, we think that these theories are just masks for other concerns, other agendas. And so we don't know if this is that important. If you want to make an argument that people owe a social obligation, let's talk. But it's hard with corporations, right? Unless we have some theory of how obligations interact once you aggregate people's money. And we don't see very many good arguments that or theories of that. So let's give you our take. This is what exists. What's correct? Well, our view is that every positive theory that we just told you about, agency cost, profit maximization, shareholder utility, they're all true. They're all true. They're all plausible. The only question is how important each one is, right? Because they're not mutually exclusive. You can have CEOs fleecing shareholders at the same time they're doing some charitable activity that the shareholders want and shareholders get utility from. Or they may be fleecing shareholders and at the same time, and perhaps even workers, at the same time allowing an employer matching program or selling green products. It's all plausible, okay? And the question for you is not which of these theories is correct. We're going to argue that there's just a different way that you should think about this problem and it has nothing to do with corporations per se, okay? Corporations are just a portion of it. Okay? So, when you think about these theories, right, here's what you should say. When you think about agency costs, just say, why do I care about corporate philanthropy as an agency cost any more than I care about a CEO having a fancier office as a form of agency cost? There's nothing different. Okay? Or, why should I care about when somebody talks about shareholder utility and trying to figure out if that's true? Just understand that the corporation in that case is just acting like a mutual fund. A mutual fund takes your money and then figures out what other companies to invest in. That's what the corporation is doing. It's taking your money and figuring out what charities or activities to engage in. Okay? And you contribute by paying more for green products or working for less or by owning stock. Okay? And it's true that sometimes corporations profit from the production of charitable activities, corporate philanthropy. But how is that different than any other good? They profit from that other good that you shouldn't concern yourself or trouble yourself because they are also profiting from engaging in corporate philanthropy. Okay? You shouldn't concern yourself about this. So what should you care about? What is the question to ask? What is the right question to ask? The right question isn't what is the proper theory of corporate philanthropy? The answer is what is the proper theory of why people want to engage in altruistic acts? Why do they want to engage in altruistic acts? And I have a word up there that you may or may not have seen called impure altruism. Impure altruism encompasses both the, you know, highly noble, I care about others, I care about how good the environment is directly, and whether or not I contribute, I care about that environment. And then the more kind of narrow, warm glow view, which is what I care about is not so much the quality of the environment, but how much I contribute to the environment. Right? It's when I write my check to the Sierra Club, which actually is a 501c4 organization for a large portion of it, but let's put that aside for a second. When I contribute, do I get utility from it? Okay? That's a little bit different. It's not does the end user, the beneficiary, benefit, it's how much do I give. Okay? And when you combine these two, the former was pure altruism, the latter is called warm glow. When you combine them, people talk about them as impure altruism. Okay? A little bit selfish, a little bit public-minded. Okay? And our view is, people want to purchase this impure altruism, and there are many ways to purchase it. The corporation is but one of the providers of this type of impure altruism. The others are nonprofit charities, right? United Way, AmeriCare, you name it. And also perhaps the government, which, depending on your political viewpoint, right? So these are all the different competitors in this market. And the question for you is not how do we explain why corporations are competing. That's just as important as asking, for example, well, why should I care that Ford is producing cars rather than Dodge? Right? That's the sort of level at which this debate is currently occurring in our view. The real question for you is why is the production of impure altruism different than other goods? Why don't I also say, well, it's just like producing cars? The answer is, it's not, for three reasons. The first is, an important component of altruism is that there's the potential for free riding. Okay? If you do something to help the environment, I benefit even if I don't do anything. That's not true with cars. When you purchase a car, that doesn't help me. I need to purchase my own car, right? So that's one thing. There's free riding on public goods, and altruism is a form of public good, at least some components of altruism. The second is there's going to be a crowd out because, unlike in most markets, right, governments don't produce cars, governments do produce this form of altruism. Okay, so we have to worry about competition from the government. And the last thing is there are increasing economies of scale, okay, which we'll explain in a second. Sometimes we'll call it economies of scale. Sometimes we'll call it signal amplification. That is, when I produce, say, a form of altruism with someone else, I get more utility than when I produce it alone. I'll explain that in a second. But here's a nice little picture, right, that explains what I'm talking about. Okay, you're the smiley face, or at least I hope you're the smiley face. Okay, you're the smiley face, and you want to purchase what I call impure altruism. Okay, and there are three competitors that are offering it to you. Now, obviously, there are thousands of competitors, because each of these boxes or circles or pentagons are just an embodiment of different firms, but there are three basic types of providers: the government, state, local, you name it, non-for-profits, right, public charities, and corporations, roughly speaking. Now, I'm not distinguishing between corporations and partnerships. That's all the same for me. They all belong in that box. They're all producing it, and they're each producing, can produce a given public good. They can all help the environment. They can all help the poor, right? They can all reduce literacy, increase literacy, reduce illiteracy. I guess that depends on your view of advertising. Again, here we go. Okay. So how do you contribute, right? How do you purchase it? Well, with the government, we already know. You pay your taxes. And just for a second, just assume the government's producing this sort of stuff without getting into, you know, internal moral debates about whether the government is good or bad, right? Put aside the libertarian inside you. You can pay taxes, and that's how you facilitate the government, right? You buy the government's altruism that the government produces. With nonprofits, you can donate money, or you can volunteer. And actually, you could actually work for a nonprofit. You could go work for the ACLU, right, after you're done here. That's another way. I just haven't drawn that in, but these are the dominant ways. Alternatively, in a corporation, you can either own the corporation, you can buy the corporation's goods, or you can work for the corporation if the corporation's doing good. Okay? Not all corporations, by the way, are doing good. I'm just saying the ones that are competing in this market. Okay? And by the way, the corporation then sometimes produces public goods directly. Sometimes it sends money over to the nonprofit. Sometimes it sends money over to the government. We call these corporate taxes. Okay? Sometimes the government takes some of the money that you pay in taxes and gives it to nonprofits. Grants. I won't talk about money that the government gives in the form of subsidies to corporations to build hybrids. That could also count too. But there are a lot of these actions going on. But to you, you should just think three possible competitors to produce this thing that I call impure altruism. And here, I've tried to assign numbers to this, right? That first slide, I told you how important is corporate philanthropy. This, I just kind of replayed that here. Just to give you a sense, there are $223 billion of donations from individuals, up to $226 billion of volunteer work, but there's also up to $84 billion of shareholder contribution. These numbers are rising, but we can't quantify them. They could be over $200 billion in our estimate, probably larger. Plus, their corporations are giving $20 billion here, at least $30 billion here. They're paying a ton of taxes, okay? And even the government's contributing to nonprofits, nearly $100 billion. What should you take out of this, other than this is a funny little picture with of a guy with a bunch of tentacles, right? What you should understand is the three competitors and the magnitudes of the numbers. The total amount of private taxes, individual taxes paid to the government, $1.23 trillion, 2006. Okay? How do private contributions to charities compare? Well, it's almost a half, nearly $500 billion. Okay? And corporate contributions, ignoring this, right, just individual contributions through corporations, maybe at least half as big as the contributions it makes to nonprofits, one-tenth of that to the government. And that's ignoring, by the way, taxes. If you include taxes, the government's just one-third the size of individual taxes, and about halfway between individual contributions to corporations and individual contributions to nonprofits. These are big numbers, to be sure, but they're comparable numbers. That's the thing that you should get out of this. This is how the market works. It's as if I'd put Ford, Dodge, BMW, all on this chart and just told you where you're buying your cars from. Same sort of thing. Okay? All right, so let me explain free riding and scale economies, because I think these are the two important distinctions. When I say impure altruism, I told you there are two different goods. There's how much you care about the environment getting better, and secondly, how much you care about you yourself contributing to the environment. The former is called pure altruism. In the literature on this, it's called big G, just kind of a way to indicate it's big, it's important, it's really caring, but big G. But it's subject to free riding. Like I said, if you help the environment, I benefit even if I don't do anything about the environment, right? If you recycle and I don't recycle, I still get the benefit of your recycling. Okay? Now, because of that, when you have free riding, individuals don't want to spend money on this, right? Because they're free riding off other people. You need some other solution. The standard solution that we talk about to free riding on public goods, on this big G, altruism, is taxes. Mandatory contributions via taxes by the government. Right? So the government solves this free riding problem. But they're not the only ones. Corporations can also solve this, and I'll explain this in just a minute. What is the other component of altruism that we care about? It's warm glow. It's my contribution to the environment. How many dollars did I give to the Sierra Club? How many dollars did I give to the World Wildlife Fund? Okay. But that is just like any private good, because when you contribute to WWF, and not the wrestling, but the world, right? Okay, when you contribute, I don't get a benefit. I don't feel happier. When I contribute, I feel happier. Your contribution doesn't help me. So it's just like any other private good. But what makes this different is economies of scale, interesting economies of scale. Let's suppose that rather than me sending money to WWF and you sending money, say a dollar to WWF, what we do is we both put in a dollar into a joint fund, and that fund, call it a corporation, contributes the $2 to WWF. Okay? The question is, did you just get utility or happiness from just that $1 contribution, or do you get the utility from the $2 amalgamated combined contribution that the corporation makes to WWF? If it's the latter, right, then you're getting this kind of economies of scale in terms of jointly contributing to charity. And there's some evidence that in fact occurs. And that evidence comes from evidence on matching donations. Okay? So there's some economies of scale when we're going. When we do it together through joint vessels, you get people are happier. They contribute more, in fact. Okay. Those are the first two things, right? Free riding and the need to solve free riding. The second one was economies of scale. The third thing that separates altruism from other goods is crowding out. Okay? Now, in some sense, there's crowding out all the time. So when I buy a car from Ford, I'm not buying one from Dodge, or I'm not buying one from GM, whatever it happens to be, right? So in some sense, a sale by Ford crowds out sales from somebody else because I don't need any more than one car. But this is a little bit different because when I buy from Ford, I'm voluntarily not contributing to Dodge and GM. But when I buy altruism from the government, it's not that I'm voluntarily contributing less to the nonprofits or the corporation. It's that the government took my money. Right? It's involuntary. So this is a little bit different. When the government engages in competition and makes you buy the good, then it's crowding out your purchases from elsewhere. Here, your purchase of altruism from nonprofits and corporations very directly. Right? And you don't control it because no individual controls what the government does. Yes, we vote and we live in a democracy. But even the most optimistic person in this way says, it's the median voter that matters and not an individual voter. Okay? I can't tell Uncle Sam to take my dollar and give it to somebody else. Don't try that either. It doesn't work. Really. But an interesting feature of this is that there's a way that you can take the money back from the government. Why? Because the government, in addition to taking your money through taxes and then spending it on good causes, will also allow you to avoid taxes by contributing money to nonprofits and in some cases to corporate philanthropy. When you do this, you're in effect taking money out of the government's hands. So your tax avoidance actually can crowd out the government. So it's not completely mandatory, but in order to do something about it, you have to engage in some tax avoidance. Not evasion. We don't do evasion. Avoidance. Okay? So this is an interesting feature that doesn't exist in other markets so much. Okay, so at this point you might say, all right, great, so we know that you're the consumer, you're purchasing pure altruism and warm glow. You're purchasing from three possible producers: the government, nonprofit charity, and the corporation. And you might ask yourself, who should I buy from? How should I buy it? Even if I buy it from the corporation, how should I buy it? Should I work for them? Should I buy their products? Should I own their stock, even though their stock isn't doing so well? Right, as long as they're doing good. And I'm going to try to give you some guidance on this. This will help us understand what the comparative advantage of corporations are in this particular market. So the first one is the following. These are simplistic ones that you could probably come up with in 5 minutes just by thinking about it. Why do I want to contribute to a corporation that gives to a charity rather than to the charity directly? Well, it could be the corporation, because they're contributing so much more, actually can monitor the charity better. Because the charity might not be doing a good job with the money that it gets, right? It has its own agency problems. And so having this corporation stand in between you and the charity may make the charity behave a little bit better. It's the idea that sometimes institutional investors are better controls over managerial shirking than individual shareholders are, right? Anybody that's taken corporate law knows about this. The corporation is like the institutional shareholder, but this time vis-a-vis the charity and the charity's managers. Another one is economies of scope. Sometimes corporations are better at producing public goods, right? I'll give you an example I used in a previous paper I think is really natural. Starbucks. You buy Starbucks coffee, and you buy fair trade Starbucks coffee, Starbucks pays a little bit more for that coffee to the coffee farmer in the developing country, right? It's basically a transfer to help them avoid poverty. Now you might say, well, I could do that directly, right? Send a check off or find a charity that'll send a check off to some coffee farmer. But the nice thing about the way that Starbucks does it is Starbucks already knows where the farmer is, can calibrate it to the amount of coffee that he or she produces, right? So it's really kind of incentivized nicely. And it doesn't require additional administrative work or superstructure. So in that sense, there's economies of scope when Starbucks is providing money to coffee growers in developing countries, right? There's economies of scope. Or it makes sense when Toyota is reducing CO2 emissions by producing hybrid cars like the Prius. Okay, they're good at it. They can do these things together in a way that the government can't and nonprofit charities can't either. A third argument for why you might like corporate philanthropy is this signal amplification argument that I just told you about, right? If I work for a firm that has a pro bono program, a law firm that has a pro bono program, it might make me happier even though I'm not actually doing the pro bono work, because the firm enables other people to do pro bono work, right? That gives me some warm glow working for them. In fact, I'll work for a little bit less because they're such a nice firm, even though I'm not doing all the pro bono work that I could do. Right? What does that mean? I'm contributing a few dollars to the firm's charitable activities. You, who are actually doing the pro bono work at this firm, are contributing direct dollars. And the warm glow that I'm getting is not just my contribution, but the combined contribution, perhaps, of both of us. I'm getting more than just my personal contribution. Okay? Signal amplification is what we call it, but it's also a form of economies of scale. And then, of course, there's the solution to free riding. Look, the best case example of this is, you know, let's put aside that Armin Hammer built an art museum just for his art, right? He built an art museum, which is a public good. I mean, his art was actually quite good, so in some sense it was a public good to get to see it. But when he does this, he's in effect forcing every stakeholder in the corporation to contribute in some sense, because without it, maybe profits would have been higher, wages could have been higher, prices of goods could have been a little bit lower, right? Price of oil in this case. And you didn't have any control over it. That agency cost, in effect, was like a tax. It took your money and contributed to some public good. A good public good that you might benefit from, but that you wouldn't have contributed directly yourself because of free riding. So that's the upside of the agency cost view of corporate philanthropy. Another view is simply, hey, look, I may invest in companies like Google or Cisco, and I don't really care about what their corporate philanthropy is. Okay, I'm a profit maximizing kind of guy. But you guys who also invest in these companies do care, or you who work at these companies do care. And so you cause the company to engage in good acts. Okay? And I am just the beneficiary because of the preference externality that's going on. The company has to decide whether or not to engage in philanthropy. This is not a dollar for dollar thing. It requires big investments, fixed costs. And so it'll pick what the average stakeholder wants. That average stakeholder is you, and you like corporate philanthropy. I, as a minority stakeholder, minority in terms of my preferences for philanthropy, don't particularly care about this, but I have to swallow this because that's how products are produced. Products are targeted towards the median or the average consumer, not esoteric consumers. and the esoteric consumers just have to suffer the cost of that. In this case, the cost is I can't free ride off of you. I'm forced to contribute too by being in the corporation. Not as good as the government because I can withdraw from the corporation, but still pretty good. And the other thing that's a little more sophisticated argument that economists have come up with recently is the following. This is about green products or green goods, right? A green good is a bundle of two other goods, right? You could either donate a dollar to the environment or buy a car. But if you buy a Prius, you're buying both those things together, okay? But sometimes that combined good has certain economies of scale, right? A Prius might be better than, let's say a Prius cost $2. It might be better than a dollar contribution to the environment and a dollar's worth of car, right? There's some combined economies of scope between those two things. That's why it's produced. Otherwise, it wouldn't sell in the economy, in the market. Well, when that happens, when you buy a Prius, you're not exactly buying one unit of environment and one unit of car. You're buying some combination for a given price. And the price that you see, the relative price of the private good, the car, and the public good, is the relative ratio embodied in that car of those two products, the car and the environment. I know this is a bit metaphysical, but bear with me for a second. So if that dollar or $2 that you spend on a Prius is three parts car and one part environmental contribution, when you buy it, instead of donating $1 to the environment and $1 to a car, right, purchasing a car, you're actually buying more car and less environment. But it could also work the other way around too. If it contains three units environment, one unit car, right, then in effect you're buying a lot of environment. And it's reduced the relative price of contributing to the environment. Before, the relative price was a dollar for dollar, dollar donation to the environment, dollar purchase of a car. Now it's different. It's 3-1. You get $3 for buying a unit of car and $1 for buying a unit of the environment, so you buy more environment. The relative price is 3-1 rather than 1-1. Okay? 3-1 the car. Car is more expensive. So that may alter the amount that you purchase when they sell these green goods of the environment and not. It could be that it's reducing the relative price of contributing to the environment, so you contribute more to the environment. Okay? So these are the arguments for why we like corporate philanthropy, the arguments for why we don't like corporate philanthropy. Well, yes, corporations can solve the agency problem between you and a charity, but it just tosses in another agency problem instead, which is the agency problem between you and the corporation. Right? You're just a shareholder. How do you make sure the corporation's doing the philanthropy that you want? Okay? So when you engage in corporate philanthropy as opposed to direct donations to nonprofits, you're just substituting one type of agency cost for another. You're taking out the agency cost between you and the charity and substituting in the agency cost between you and the corporation. A second thing is, well, anybody that knows a little bit of economics knows that just as green goods could have altered the relative price of the public good to helping the environment and the private good, the car, in a way that favors purchasing the public good, the environment, it could do the opposite. It could make cars cheaper. And so people donate less to the environment implicitly through the purchase of green goods and buy more car, right? Think about a hybrid Hummer, right? That would be your example. Okay, the last one, and the one that's, driving people away, and I haven't even started, taxes, right? Taxes. Taxes are very, very important. If you go back a few slides, I can go back more, but you'll see that you have these three competitors and all these different ways to donate. If they just competed in a free market, you'd maybe pick the one that was most efficient. Okay? Putting aside the free riding issue, maybe you pick the one that was most efficient. But they're not, because these different prongs are treated differently under tax law. And so in effect, the government has chosen and said, we prefer this arm, to that arm, things like that. And that will affect how you donate, okay? But in a way that might not be correlated with the comparative advantages, the true economic comparative advantages of a corporation. So let me give you an example. This is going to be painful to concentrate on, so let me just summarize what's going on. And don't squint. You'll get glasses later on. It'll be bad. Yeah, that's not what you should get. Well, you're going to get that anyway from law school. Glasses. Okay, so what's going on here? Sorry, you get to see a little bit of my Mac desktop too in the process. There are four ways that you can contribute to philanthropy. You can do it individually and directly, or you can do it through some sort of corporation, either by being a shareholder, by being an employee, or by being a consumer. And each dollar that you donate through these different mechanisms is taxed differently. The one thing you probably do know is that if you make a direct donation to a charity, and assuming that you're an itemized deductor, Every dollar you donate to charity is a dollar that's deductible from your taxable income, right? In effect, it's subsidized by your tax rate, whatever that happens to be. Small now, high later, okay? So you get a one-level deduction equal to your personal income tax. That's the deduction. Of course, it's capped. But that's not going to be a concern. It's a 50% cap. You're not going to probably get close to that. Now, there's actually another way that you may not know about where you can get really good returns on your donation. Returns meaning tax subsidy on your donations to charity. And you should definitely do this. And even though I know this, I don't do it. And there's a reason, because it's sometimes cumbersome. But if you were going to donate a big amount, you should do it this way. That is to say, if you want to fleece the government and help the charity. And that is to donate stock. So take some stock that you've invested in that's appreciated and donate that stock. Why is that good? You don't have to pay the capital gains tax on the appreciation, and whatever the appreciated amount is, that's counted as a deduction, just like a cash deduction is. So you get two deductions. You implicitly get a capital gains tax deduction, and you get a deduction of labor income taxes in the amount of the contribution. You get to sum those two things up. Fantastic, right? It's a great way to contribute. In fact, dominates everything else. You should do it. Very few people do, despite this. So it's very hard to understand what to do with this possibility. Charities know about this, and they try to get you to do it, but very people still do. Alternatively, you can donate with labor, right? Now, you might say, well, when I volunteer, I don't get to report that as a deduction on my income tax. So clearly, that's not subsidized, right? That's wrong. In fact, de facto, you might think of volunteering as being subsidized or having the same tax preference as a cash contribution. And the reason is, the implicit assumption here is that when you spend 1 hour working for Habitat for Humanity, that's one less hour that you're working. And so you're making one less hour of wage. Okay? And if that's the case, then yes, you're donating labor and you don't get to mark it on your taxes. But by working 1 hour less, by being forced to work 1 hour less, you're getting 1 hour less of wages. And so in effect, your taxable income is falling anyway. Okay? So you're getting a tax subsidy that way. Now, obviously, you might be on salary, and it might not matter, and you may have to work anyway all these extra hours, in which case you're actually getting no subsidy. But if work hours and charity hours are fungible, right, are trading off, then you're, in effect, getting a tax subsidy. But again, it's the same as the cash donation. What if you're a shareholder? What benefit do you get here? And I'm going to use as the baseline your cash contributions to charities. You're actually better off than a cash contribution to charity. And the reason is very simple. When a corporation makes a contribution to charity, and you're the shareholder of that corporation, you get to take two deductions multiplied by each other. One is the corporation pays less taxes because it gets to take a charitable deduction. And the implication of that is you avoid those taxes. Okay? And because it's made a contribution, the amount of profits that it shows to you when it issues a dividend check to you is also lower. So you get to take a labor income tax deduction. You multiply those two together, that's pretty good. You get to add a two-level deduction when a corporation contributes that you don't get to take when you privately contribute cash. Okay? So you would think being a shareholder and contributing is a good thing. Corporations can fleece the government, give to charities. I only say that tongue-in-cheek partly, right? It depends on your view of the government. You get to take get greater subsidies for your contributions when you do it through a corporation. Not true relative to donating stock, but very few people do that, so I'm going to cabin that, okay? It's relative to private contributions. You prefer a corporation to contribute. Okay? And it's true whether the corporation contributes cash, contributes workers' time by paying for pro bono activities, contributes by doing nice things for the environment directly, right, by not polluting. All those things have the same basic treatment. Okay? And obviously, if you're a shareholder, you're not working for the corporation. I'm treating that separately. What if you're an employee? What do you get? What do you get? Well, if you're making a matching contribution, right, so your employer says, hey, you donate $1,000 to United Way, I will match that with $1,000 of my own. Well, that's just like an individual cash contribution. And the reason is because when you contribute $1,000, right, and the corporation does, that corporation says, well, that's $1,000 I would have given this guy as income anyway, right, and that person would have donated in cash contribution. So they're functionally treated the same as a cash contribution, okay? And paid pro bono work, which might be treated a little bit differently, right? That was a matching contribution of donation to a nonprofit. Paid pro bono work is treated just like volunteer time. Why? Because if you're doing paid pro bono work, and no matter how, I like Wachtell Lipton quite a bit, but they'll pay you a little bit less because they're paying for your pro bono work. Okay? It's going to come out of your pocket in some sense, in some way. And because it does that, it's just like volunteer work. It's an hour less you're spending making productive work. And they'll tell you otherwise, but on average, that's going to be the case. Otherwise, they're losing money. Okay. So an employee, if you donate through batching programs, it's just like direct cash donations. If you do pro bono work, you could have just volunteered on your own. Same sort of thing. Okay? Don't be so glum. Still good, right? You're going to help people. The consumer. This is the fastest growing segment here. This is growing unbelievable rates, right? You can't think about the Super Bowl. And this is easy for me to do. Think about the Super Bowl. Even the Super Bowl, right? This bastion of the old boys network cares about the environment so much so that last year they spent a lot of effort buying carbon offsets to make sure, ignoring the corporate jet activity, to make sure that the Super Bowl itself didn't contribute to CO2, net CO2 emissions, okay? Even when the Super Bowl starts producing green products, then you really think this is important, okay? But here's the kicker. When you buy a good that's a green good, you get no tax break. You're buying in after-tax dollars, period. Is the least subsidized activity. The government likes it when you do that because they don't lose tax revenue, but the charity doesn't. So this is the least favored. Now, why do I want you to think about this? These are all equal economic ways to contribute, without knowing anything more, contribute to the public good or to contribute to impure altruism. But they're taxed differently. This is the worst taxed. This is the second worst taxed, ignoring donations of stock, which are rare. And these two, this is taxed just like this guy, and this guy maybe slightly better. So shareholders are good, individuals and workers, a little worse off, but together, and consumers are the worst. So now let's jump to, I'm gonna not talk about Berkshire Hathaway. This is a fun little program, but I want to conclude. What should you take away from this talk? One, every theory of corporate philanthropy is in some sense true. Okay, the only question is how true? How important? Okay? But despite that, it's not helping you understand how to think about philanthropic activity, actions by corporations. You shouldn't focus on the market for cars by just focusing on Ford. Focus on the entire market. Here the market is for altruism, the warm glow kind and the pure altruism kind. And you need to think about corporations versus nonprofits versus the government. Which do you like? Why do we favor one as opposed to the other for producing these public goods? This is how you should understand corporate philanthropy. It's a competitor, not an end. Okay? The second thing you should take away from this is there are a lot of arguments for and against corporate philanthropy versus, say, government philanthropy or nonprofit philanthropy. Okay? I give you a few of them. But unless you know deep in your heart that one of those is right and one of those are wrong, or there's a net balance that favors or disfavors the corporation, you just step away and say, I don't know why tax should mess things up, because taxes aren't cued to economics. They're arbitrary modifications of prices. Now I'm starting to sound like Milton Friedman again, so I apologize. But I'm at Chicago. I have to do a little bit of that. But the key thing is, unless you've got a theory of corporate philanthropy that you totally think is absolutely right, pro or con, don't mess with taxes. You should tax all these methods for providing for philanthropy, corporate, nonprofit, or government, the same. Okay? Certainly within the corporation. Consumers, shareholders, workers, and individuals should be taxed the same when they make their contributions, and they're not now. The last thing is, you should think about why you might like corporate philanthropy as opposed to other things. You personally, right? And there are two arguments that you may not have thought about. Certainly the literature hasn't spent very much time talking about. And one is the signal amplification idea, for which there's some suggestive evidence in a lot of different places, but no direct study that tries to identify how big this amplification is. This is something that we should study, but it's also something you should think about. Do you care? Does it make you happy when somebody else at your work is doing pro bono work? If it does, and you implicitly are taking a wage hit perhaps for that, you've got maybe a little bit of this going on. And then you need to think about this green goods idea, right? When you buy a Prius, the Prius is not just good because it's helping the environment, but it's changing the relative prices of cars and donations to the environment. Maybe in a good way, maybe in a bad way. The question is the Prius increasing net contributions to the environment or decreasing net contributions to the environment? Okay? That's kind of an important issue in deciding whether you like corporate philanthropy, because corporate philanthropy is really how we produce these green goods. And finally, again, this is getting back to your faith or lack of faith in the government. Crowd out's really important here. When the government taxes you to provide public goods, you, on average, are going to reduce your contributions to nonprofits. You may actually also reduce your contributions to corporations. That has been studied less rigorously. But that kind of crowd out works in the other way, too. When you engage in tax avoidance, I guess I'm just giving you some a moral guilt trip. You're reducing, when you avoid taxes in your charitable contributions, you're reducing charitable contributions or philanthropy produced by the government. Okay? Depends on whether you like that. And so this is how you should think about corporate philanthropy, I think. And let me, with that, stop and open it up to about 3 minutes of questions. I'll stay after 1:20 in case anybody has questions. But any questions? Yes.
Yeah. There are definitely, I think there are instances where they do for Energy Star, washer, dryer, you can get a tax benefit. And same, depending on what your state, for hybrid cars, you can either get a tax benefit or, like in Virginia, you can drive it carpooling.
Totally agree. In certain instances, sometimes notable, like hybrids, there can be subsidies that promote your purchase. Now, the question is, do they promote your purchase to the same extent as a charitable contribution? So if I take the environmental component of my purchase of a Prius, do I get to deduct that from taxes? Is that the equivalent that I get in the form of a subsidy? And maybe, maybe not. But again, that's not systematic. It's for particular products, particular sectors. Right? When I buy fair trade coffee, I'm not getting a deduction. And there's I buy a lot of stuff at Starbucks, so that frequently happens. And I guess that given that you're in a law school and study so much, you might do the same. Other questions? These are just general statements. With some exceptions, yes.
Well, I was wondering, when you're looking at the economies of scale for the warm glow that you feel, how do you separate the warm glow you get from the contribution from, let's say, the oceanic feeling you get when you're a part of a membership organization or part of a contributing community?
Well, I'm kind of grouping that together. So I'll give you a simple example that'll illustrate the difference. When I, at the end of each year, make a charitable contribution by sitting down at my desk at home and write a check, I'm getting none of the joint warm glow, okay? But when I go and I'm not going to use Habitat for Humanity as an example, but when I, for example, contribute to the charitable auction here, right, I don't just say, oh, I've contributed $125 or whatnot. What I care about is how much total was contributed overall, right? So I care about the numbers that they send you about the charitable auction this year raised, you know, $200,000. For some reason, that matters to me, right? And that's the distinction. And sometimes you should lump those together, sometimes you don't. I put them all in the category of warm glow because I didn't directly do that $200,000. And, you know, I don't know what's going to happen, and I've only contributed $125,000, and I don't know what's going to happen with the $200 contributions I make to United Way or whatnot, right, when I write the check at the end of the year. It's just a good feeling that I get, and that's what's in common about both of these things. You see, I get a good feeling when I see that last charitable foundation letter that says this is how much we've raised, and I feel like I was a part of that.
Are there any studies on how corporate philanthropy affects which charities get the incomes? I mean, if you're a corporation, you'll probably want to donate to Red Cross or Heifer's Nest, which is large and equality, while if you're a small person, you might donate to startup philanthropy or your local church or synagogue or mosque, which doesn't get corporate donations.
Yeah. The two aspects of this. One is, if you look at the breakdown, and I have it to a local art house or something like that, whereas a corporation is going to give to bigger entities, like the Art Institute. And so you see that. So entrepreneurs, artistic entrepreneurs, know that there's a difference between what it takes to get funded by a corporation and what it takes to get funded by an individual donor. Now, it's not systematic, and we don't know what is better. Different does not necessarily mean worse, so it's hard to judge, but it does occur. And with religion, it's very hard to tell. There's an argument that religion is just a club good, and it's not a public good, and there's also good arguments that churches, mosques, synagogues, and so on and so forth do provide public goods, help the poor, soup kitchens, things like that. So it's very hard to judge. There are differences, though. Should we stop? Yeah, let's stop now. If anybody has any more questions, I'll be here afterwards outside.